finally gave Doc a kick in the shin as we rode up to the third floor. I gave him a sign with my eyes as to the third of our grouping. "What is it with you?" Doc said. At three, Garbo made a speedy exit, knowing her cover was blown, at least for one of us. She was gone. Doc said, "What are you up to?" "That was Garbo, you blockhead." "What, that old bag in men's clothes? No, it wasn't." "It totally was, and you scared her off." New paintings. Maurice Ravel, Paul Bowles, Harry's Bar, Cuckoo's Garage, On the Channel, Pascal and the Rotund, The Ghost of 61st Street, The Haunted Bookshop, Ned Roram, Archery, The Girl with the Flaxen Hair. New movies. Diabolique, The Wages of Fear, Violette, Remember My Name, Cabaret, Days of Heaven, Apocalypse Now, The Shining, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Celine and Julie Go Boating. New records. Chairs Missing, Wire. Manifesto, Roxy Music. The Rascals' Greatest Hits. Goodbye and Hello, Tim Buckley. The Lodger, David Bowie. Hot Rats, Frank Zappa. Preludes, Debussy. See You at the Fair, Ben Webster. Desmond Blue, Paul Desmond. ESP, Miles Davis. 7 Steps to Heaven, Miles Davis. Blues and the Abstract Truth, Oliver Nelson. Something Cool, June Christie. Lionheart, Kate Bush. December 1st. Film premiere of Elaine, A Story of Lost Love, at 1 Sheridan Square. Jay Hoberman writes, Andrew Horn and John Meany have adapted a de Maupassant story into a well-crafted, if precious, vehicle for Black-Eyed Susan and other luminaries of the Ridiculous Theater Company. With Adam McAdam, Lisa Jane Persky, and me. Showing with Still Moving, Patti Smith, by Robert Mapplethorpe. Joan's Face, by Barry Schill. And Tarzam, by Rudy Burkhart, starring Taylor Mead. Showtime at 11 p.m., $2.75. It was black and white, but tinted with colors. A work of art needs a set of rules. In an avant-garde world, the real risk might be in being a neoconservative. Sometimes painting is a form of wishful thinking, escapism, a way to balance out an irrational world. I'm interested in an art that lasts. I walked down to the only rock club in my neighborhood, Hurrah, run by impresario Jim Ferrat. Tonight there was a kerfuffle because Dim Bulb, Sid Vicious, who's out on bail, had a brief altercation with Patti Smith's brother, Todd, and in no time at all, he cut Todd's cheek open with a broken glass, narrowly missing his eye. There was screaming and shouting and overturned stools and cops. I was thinking, if this is punk, forget it. Stupid, mindless posturing from a sodden moron. Back to Rikers for Sid. I walked back home. Jean Seberg dead at 40. She was found in a car in Paris with a bottle of barbiturates. She'd been undergoing psychiatric treatment. The FBI had been hassling her. I went to a Brassai photography show at Marlborough, and the man himself was sitting alone in a corner, big, bulging eyes. Also, Matisse drawing show at the Guggenheim. I have a new friend, Bart Gorin from Chicago. Came to New York to be a hustler. Best friends with Ray Johnson. They go down to the Anvil every night. He's very funny and debonair in a rumpled, preppy kind of way. I go over to his apartment on 72nd Street to watch a cable TV show called TV Party, hosted by Glenn O'Brien. It's like a new wave version of Playboy After Dark. Glenn loves Hugh Hefner. Who doesn't? Also, Jimmy DeSana, a diminutive photographer I met through the File magazine crowd. He had a famous image of himself hanging by the neck naked with an erection. His boyfriend is Robert Stefanati, who has a 57th Street gallery. Jimmy lives on 6th Avenue, cruises in Bryant Park at night for cutthroat Puerto Rican boys. Jimmy is quiet and droll and likes to go to parties with me. He looks a little like Tyrone Power. He hardly drinks. My body is trying to kill me. My heartbeat jars my vision. The jangle of my own blood is in my ears. Saw the Clash at the Academy of Music. Fucking great. We've got a beautiful new kitten called Lucian. He's gray and white, and Cuckoo is in love with him. So am I. Nothing like a kitten to bring a smile to your face. He is chronically unemployed. Loses interest fast. Hired and fired with the switch of a tail. Terry went to D.C. to visit her separated parents. I laid in some supplies. I went to the New York Magazine Christmas party and checked my new brown tweed herringbone topcoat from Brooks Brothers, gift from Dad. I had several drinks, wandering around the desks, thinking about office parties I'd seen in the movies, e.g. The Apartment. I said Merry Christmas to Mayor Ed Koch. How am I doing? Was his stock reply. I had to get downtown to Tier 3, so looked for my coat. I found one that might have been it, so put it on and took the train down to West Broadway, where X from Los Angeles was playing. Gordon Stevenson is married to singer Exene's sister, Muriel. So I was introduced to Exene and frontman John Doe. Exene came on to me in a cat-like way, telling me she and her husband, John, had an understanding. She must have smelled the doom in me. Some girls are attracted to beauty and ruins, like moths to a flame. It's a kind of bad chemistry. I didn't fancy the idea and took my drunken leave. I must have overshot on the subway because I couldn't find my apartment building. They all looked alike to me. It was snowing pretty hard, and I was running out of gas. So I stopped in one that vaguely resembled mine and pushed the elevator button. The doorman said, "Hey, where you going?" "Home," I replied in a surly voice. "You don't live here." "Aw, leave me alone." And I curled up on a couch in the lobby. "Hey, you can't sleep there. Get out of here right now before I call the cops." I collected myself, cursing the inhumanity of the world, and stepped back out into the blizzard. By some miracle, I did find my apartment building and took the elevator to the second floor, dug in my coat pocket for the key. No key. Wrong coat. Fuck! I had a bright idea. The laundry room was on my floor, and there was an empty closet that I might just tuck into for the night. I wandered in, and sure enough, there was just the spot for my drunken slumber. I closed the door behind me and settled on the dirty floor. In the morning, I awoke in my dark chamber to the sound of a nice yuppie couple doing their laundry. What to do? I listened to their gay repartee, presuming themselves alone. 10 minutes went by. Only one way out. I stood up, brushed some dust kittens off my gray flannel suit, straightened my fedora, and entered the brightly lit room. They stood back, horrified. I tipped my hat and said, "Good morning," and sauntered out. That's a scene they won't soon forget. I did a job with M & Company, 25 West 39th. Tibor Kalman and Carol Bukanowitz, for Paragon's sporting goods store. Pretty awful. Then they borrowed my collage book and did a record cover for the Stones. A collage. Coincidence? Maybe not. I did spots for High Times, CBS Records, lots of New York Magazine. Still living below the poverty level, but it's moving. Stasis is the enemy. E.E. Cummings writes about Harry Crosby. Two Boston dolls, found with holes in each other's lullaby and other lullabies by unbroken lullaby, by the she and him with the he and her, and both all hopped up prettily. More books. Ghost Story, Peter Straub. Mysteries, Newt Hampson. Our Mother's House, Julian Gloag. Other Voices, Other Rooms, Truman Capote. The Country Girls, Edna O'Brien. The Girl with the Green Eyes, Edna O'Brien. Spy Story, Len Dayton. The Disenchanted, Bud Schulberg. The Pat Hobby Stories, F. Scott Fitzgerald. The Big Knockover, Dashiell Hammett. New Work, Joe Brainard. Selected Work, Joe Brainard. La Chatte, Colette. The Crack Up, F. Scott Fitzgerald. Miss Lonely Hearts, Nathaniel West. The Snow Was Black, Georges Simenon. The Deer Park, Norman Mailer. The Final Diary, Ned Roram. Giovanni's Room, James Baldwin. February 27, 1980. Beyond the New Wave, an exhibition of representational paintings at Club 57, 57 St. Mark's Place. It was the brainchild of David McDermott, who brought in a couple of other painters. We rented the Kooky Nightclub for the night from Almondide and Magnuson for $100. We were hoping to lure real art dealers from Soho or 57th Street so we could start being real painters. I showed 11 paintings, the most expensive being the Twin Gynecologists at $750. McDermott pulled out a couple days before, because we vetoed some screwball idea he had. I said it was a democracy. This inflamed him. He said, "Who cares about painting anyway? I don't." And left with a slamming of the door. He thought us losers should all be grateful to be under the wing of a genius P.T. Barnum-type entrepreneur, such as he. Edward Brzezinski enlisted a second-generation New York school poet, Tim Dugos, from Washington, D.C., to write an essay for our InstiPrint program. He bought one of my pictures, called The Second Ghost Painting, $500. We invited all our friends. Ray Johnson came, smelling of aqua de selva. Bart in a cowboy hat, Black Bart. Painter Frank Moore, Joe Brainard. Blonde appropriationist Sarah Charlesworth. Howard Reed from Robert Miller. The East Village Eye, Betsy Sessler, Kathy Acker, Amos Poe. So much of contemporary art seems like empty things for empty people. Clichés aren't clichés if you happen to believe in them. I use the New York Picture Library for illustration, also for my personal work. Nothing like pouring through folders full of pictures to get the imagination going. Images that trigger the mind in different directions. Staircases, viaducts, embankments, motorboats, mirrors, curtains, subways. A kind of visual free association. I spent a lot of time in there, accumulating a stack of mounted pictures that I'll check out and ponder for a couple of weeks. A representational painter needs subject matters dear to him, or at least challenging. What could I do with that? Maybe incorporate that thing that Hopper does. Plus, I can travel through the ages, not restricted by today, which I'm not aesthetically sold on anyhow. Free to roam. Walking in others' footsteps to see how it feels, how it fits. The endless collective image bank crying out for reinterpretation. A vast resource of raw material. It's a great way of honing my sensibilities. Fine-tuning my antennae. One of my themes is a dream of Europe. Not necessarily the way it is, but the way it existed in my mind before I had a handle on it. I remember when I was 10 and seeing it for the first time, how everything seemed foreign, even the gas stations and airports. Things that were familiar yet alien at the same time. I know this, I don't know this. Forced me to look harder, which is what separates painters from civilians. So I'd ask myself questions. What is the visual information that is unsettling me? What's different? What is the essence of old Europe, of foreignness? What might that look like? How could you add the atmosphere of a thriller to a cityscape without painting like a pulp illustrator? How to suggest psychological tension without any actually being enacted? How does love look? Big Picasso show opens at MoMA. Love the early work, Rose period. Saltimbanques, sloppy neoclassicism. Before he began to believe in his own myth. May, 1980. Saw the Pretenders at the Academy of Music. What a sound. They tore it up. Proper rock stars. Went to a loft party at Vito Acconci's with writer Judy Lopatin. We were drunk on cheap red wine. It was dark and loud. Who should enter, most incongruously, but French film idol Jean-Pierre Aumont, Lily, and his naughty daughter, Tina, partner. Looking like a couple, so glamorous. Checking out New York's underground. Judy and I retired to a corner to make out. I hope that before the No Waivers disappear into some irresistible sewer, someone decides to make a film in which there is some tension between the camera and its subject. The Mud Club a la Late Visconti. Soho Weekly News. New joint opened at 77 White Street in Tribeca, called the Mud Club. Situated in a narrow industrial street with deserted alleyways, very noir. Darkness stained with light. Inside, a whole new crop of arty kids getting high. Hard-up artists being good to their mad little sins. Second-string literary figures in their mucked-up finery. Mr. Milltown and the Cognac Cowboy burying their faces in fumes. Doing them good by doing them in. A gaggle of ugly girls in majorette boots, ashamed of being unhappy. New boys at large looking for hot monkey love. A climate of narcotics. A neurosis in the air, mistaken for energy. The new pissiness. Saw a fresh new band from Athens, Georgia, called the B-52s. The singer wore a seersucker jacket and white bucks, like he was going to a southern country club dance. Pencil mustache. The girls had beehive hairdos and satin prom dresses. The crowd of aspiring whatevers loved them. Dancing to their single, Rock Lobster. Afterwards, we had chocolate egg creams and cheeseburgers at the brightly lit Dave's Luncheonette on Canal Street. We've been running into the new Bohemians as they settle into this new scene that's unfolding at the Mud. Cookie Mueller, gorgeous Anna Schroeder, pale Wendy Whitelaw, William Coupon, Kirsten Bates, Ado, Mary Paul, Kate Simon, Bobby Grossman, Stephen Mueller, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Marcus Leatherdale, Claudia Summers, Anita Sarko, Stephen Sabin, David Armstrong, Lisa Stroud, Glenn O'Brien, Tina Lahotsky, Hal Ludeker, Gordon Stevenson, James Chance, Lisa Rosen, James Nares, the Lurie Brothers, John and Evan, Duncan Smith, Howie Montauk, David Rattray, and Dr. Mudd himself, Steve Mass. All regulars at this den of iniquity. They go night after night and the night after that. Terry and I even brought director Jerzy Skolimowski down there. We loved his new film, The Shout, with Alan Bates and Susanna York. We'd interviewed him in his hotel suite for the Soho News. Funny to see a European intellectual survey this decadent scene with gravitas, rubbing his chin and casting his eyes left and right. Saw the Cramps play the Mud, and Bacchus and I went down to the basement dressing room. They were ghoulish and sweaty, and Lux Interior made a running dive, catapulted over the back of the couch, and landed on his head on the cement floor. Knocked himself unconscious. Poison Ivy looked on uninterestedly. These guys are hardcore. New films. Gloria. Lulu. Every Man for Himself. Stardust Memories. Peppermint Soda. Terry and I go over to Kathy Acker's East Village apartment, which is full of books. She's one of the most passionate readers I've ever met. I don't really care for her work, sadly, but I certainly like her. Totally lively, funny, non-judgmental character. She used to perform in live sex shows on Times Square. We talk about Scottish author Alexander Trokey, and she lends me several out-of-print editions. Kathy and her current boyfriend, Jeff Goldberg, who's writing a book on opium called Flowers in the Blood, invite me and Terry up to Bard for a reading she's giving. Not a good idea, because I've been on a long, exhausting bender. It's kind of like having the flu. Never sober, and yet always hungover. Totally in the grips of John Barleycorn. I have to let nature take its course. I would be hard-pressed to describe a bender at this point in my life as fun. But we go nonetheless. Get in the train in my beautiful caramel-colored tweed cheruti suit and small valise full of vodka bottles. The Hudson whooshes past. We arrive at the manor house for the reading, which is straight out of an old English drawing room murder movie, and we're sitting in back as Kathy reads. I begin to flip out. I start heckling Kathy. She laughs and has some fast comebacks for me. The students shush me. The English teachers are angry. The only person who doesn't mind is Kathy herself. She thinks it's theater. Bless her. The next chapter of this blackout finds me alone and lost in the campus roads, under the dark brown sky perforated with stars. The dark so dark it had motion. Security discovered me ranting to no one in a ditch, in a horizontal position. When I stood up, my pants fell down. Bit of slapstick humor thrown in for good measure. How ignoble. I was returned to the room we were given. Terry was hearing voices in her head, and she stabbed me in the chest with a small penknife she keeps in her bag. The little blade bounced off a bone, a searing bulb of pain. Ouch! This because the voices were teasing her about my so-called harem. Terry, there is no harem. But the voices insisted. I couldn't talk her down. All in all, a disgraceful return to my alma mater. Back at the New York Public Library, atoning for my sins, looking up files on attics, the sides of ships, tunnels, movie theaters, burglars, military schools, gates, garages, poplars, lion tamers. I'm going to try painting with spiritual butter. The trick is to keep on wanting something. Duncan had his telescope out, spying on Manhattan, said Terry. One day we're walking up Fifth Avenue, and Terry pops into Charles Jourdain. Yoko Ono is trying on boots. John Lennon is sitting next to her in a slouch hat, leather jacket, and blue jeans. A Beatle! He looks up at me. The ghost of a smile crosses his face. I give a tiny nod. Terry's oblivious to all this. She asks my opinion on a pair of boots in a stroppy voice. Then John does smile, because we're in the same boat, out shopping with our headstrong lady friends. Yoko asks him a question, and the connection is broken. Jimmy DeSanta had a party at his loft by Bryant Park. Big, sweaty crowd. I was talking to tall, gaunt photographer Peter Hujar about Marcus Leatherdale. Peter said, "His name sounds like a retirement home for leather queens." Indeed, Marcus looks like he was created by Tom of Finland. Upstairs neighbor Keith Haring is there. He asked me to visit his studio a month ago, and I saw his black and white graffiti drawings of dogs and babies. I thought, this poor guy doesn't have a chance. But of course I didn't say that. I told him it all looked good. Sweet, awkward guy. Meanwhile, jazz funkster James Chance gets into a fist fight with someone much bigger than him. The crowd backs up as they fall to the floor slugging. James is getting pounded, now bleeding. It happens at almost every party I go to. James must have a pugilist nature. He always loses. Always got a black eye in the boil. He's got a nice pompadour and looks good in his LeMay Vegas get-ups, fronting James White and the Blacks. Terry's going to be on the cover of his Bi LP in a skimpy blue bikini designed by James's girlfriend, Anya Phillips, part of the new wave dominatrix circle. Meanwhile, as the party gets noisier and noisier, I'm getting quite pissed, as is my wont to do. I need to use the John, but there's a long line, and whoever's in there is in no hurry to come out. Sex? Drugs? Death? I can't hold it any longer, so I go to a secluded window that I think opens onto an air shaft. I aim and let loose a golden shower. That's better. I zip up and go back into the fray. Just then, photographer Francesco Scavullo storms in, enraged. He'd been leading the party when suddenly a stream of pee rained down in his trademark black fedora. "Who did it?" he demands of Jimmy. "Who?" Scavullo has never had such an indignity perpetrated on him in his entire life. He's livid. Jimmy doesn't know, but he has a pretty good idea, and apologizes profusely for whichever of his disgusting guests urinated on his hat. Jimmy calls me in the morning to ask if I happened to pee out his window last night. I confess, and he scolds me in his mild way. I secretly find it very funny. Peeing on Scavullo's hat? What a capital idea. Terry smiles in this knickerless lunar night. Her mouth is full of stars. Irish nudity in repose, muddy white. Breasts palely touched with freckles. Schoolgirl skin. Rabbit ears folded back. Two eyes roaming. A tiny moist mushroom rises from her ginger-haired triangle and says, "Hello!" I put an index finger in her pleat, cut like cashmere. I rise above her starfish body, take her in and take her out. We're deep divers. We're sunken ships. She was streaming. She was undoing everywhere, singing from her loins, head flung to the side. We are alone in the whispering, wet, dark. I'll walk out of here tomorrow, and it'll be New York. Everything screwy is normal in this damn town, I'll think to myself. I'll pass Verdi Square, where the time and temperature is on the old Central Savings Bank. Crossing Amsterdam, crossing Broadway, past cornices and colonnades. I'll walk down to the river, shimmering with snakes of light, in the shadow of approaching rain. I'll look at the jumble of colored smudges, and the sunset over the Palisades ablaze with crimson and gold. Better today, better tomorrow. Terry did a reading upstairs at the Mud Club with the legendary Lester Bangs. She went on first, and was reading a piece on the etiquette of a slave to his dominatrix. It had appeared in the new issue of Bomb, illustrated by me. It got pretty gnarly. Lester was very drunk and stoned on barbs, sitting in the front row, and he began to groan. Terry paused politely, then continued with her text. Lester lurched to his feet and stumbled towards her, paused, and then careened to her left, collapsing behind a screen. We wouldn't be hearing from him again tonight. He was gone. People fall apart all the time. Every day the mailbox is stuffed with invitations to various events. We went to a white tie party for Giorgio Armani at Studio 54, the elegant playground for the international jet set. There was fake snow, fashion models, pulsing music. There was Truman Capote, hanging over the light booth, transfixed by the dance floor, pinned on prescription drugs. He looked like a waxwork from Madame Tussauds, a zombie. We wandered from catwalk to balcony, viewing the spectacle, danced to Chic's Good Times, an oddly melancholic song, as if there were no good times. Said hi to Andy and Bianca. Took in the fevered scene in the unisex lavatories. We walked home in our fancy dress like a couple of Cinderellas, Terry's ice-blue floor-length gown trailing behind her. I say, "Come on, Clarabel." Did a job on children's friendships for Self magazine at Alexander Lieberman's request. I loved his book on artist studios. They paid me $600. Another on botulism for New York Magazine for $300. One for Rolling Stone on the pinball game Space Invaders. Another for Esquire, $300. Essence, National Lampoon, $2,000. It gets easier. Keeping Up. I got very excited by composer Ned Roram's Paris Diary and New York Diary, written by a young man on the make, obsessed with art, sex, and alcohol. Big identification. I found an LP called Songs of Love in the Rain by Roram, with a beautifully sad piano piece that I play over and over. I knew he lived on 70th Street, so I walked up and down his block off Central Park one night, listening for the sound of a piano. It didn't work. Poet Tim Dugos came over one afternoon, loved my small oil portrait of Roram, and said, "I know Ned. Let me give him a call and see if we can go over there." We did. Ned ushered us in, still very handsome, with a blue scarf wrapped around his neck. He had a cold. He introduced us to his cat, Wallace. Served us tea and cookies, gossiped with Tim about New York school poets they know in common. Tim funny and laughing. Ned, not so much. Talking out of the side of his mouth, with a pronounced lisp. He was lamenting the loss of his youth and beauty, which he has been lamenting since he was young and beautiful. That's his thing. A self-fulfilling prophecy. I asked him something about his old friend Paul Bowles, and Ned quoted himself. I had heard him on the Dick Cavett Show tell the same anecdote last week. I admired his art collection, Joe Brainard's, Jane Freilicher's, Cocteau, etc. Ned seemed to eye me with suspicion, and Tim told me to get out my portrait, which I did, and propped it up in the carpet in front of the TV. Silence. Wallace came over and sniffed it, then wandered off. I don't think Wallace likes it, Ned said without smiling. He continued, I know the photo you used for your painting, Henri Cartier-Bresson. That's when I dyed my hair blonde, of course. My suit was brown, not blue. And my tie was red, not green. Well, I only had that black-and-white photo, I replied, shyly. That seemed to be about it. So I put the painting back in its brown paper bag. We thanked Ned for the visit and filed out. Tim was embarrassed and said, Sorry about that. I thought he'd be a little more enthusiastic. Maybe it was just because of his cold. That's okay, Tim. I guess he just didn't like it. I hope when I'm in my late 50s, some young kid brings over a portrait of me that he's done. And, I must add, it's a fucking good painting. Not that all my paintings are, but this one is. Terry's touchiness is always on alert. Sometimes I'm damned if I do and damned if I don't. I can sense a fracture in her life. She says I'm trying to control her by offering her advice. When she has an attack of the crazies, she can get quite violent. Once I was standing in the doorway of her office, and she was screaming at me for some imagined infidelity, some groundless fears. The energy was escalating, and suddenly she launched her heavy electric typewriter at me. I did a quick two-step, and it crashed where my feet had been. There would have been some broken bones had I not Nijinsky'd out of the way. Once she told me that I was never going to get out of this love affair alive. It seemed to be more than an idle threat. It's coming up on 3 years now. There's been quite a bit of deterioration since the relative innocence of the first flowering of romance. Emotional fatigue. Now it's flowers of evil, to borrow a phrase from old Charlie Baudelaire. The Times Square Show, June 24th, 1980, 201 West 41st Street. A group show organized by Colab, who have taken the bull by the horns. They got the use of an empty massage parlor off Times Square. I have 5 paintings in it, in spite of not fitting in with the show's agenda. Portraits of Ned Roram, Colin Wilson, Wyndham Lewis, which Glenn O'Brien bought for $300, and 2 nudes. One of Italian starlet Leonora Fanny, and the other of Jane Birkin. Hung near a couple of Walter Robinson's pulp paintings. Most of the other work has a rough political edge. Do-it-yourself anti-fascist art done with cheap materials. Rats, hypodermic needles, burial boys, hookers. This is the general tone. The Village Voice put artist John Ahern on their cover, with some headline about the new presence of young voices who demand to be heard. These scruffy ghetto dwellers are barging into the art world, it said in effect. It worked on the dealers. Jimmy's boyfriend, Stefanotti, asked me to have a show in a few months' time. Me being the lesser of evils contained in the Times Square show. My pictures would not seem to have an axe to grind with art history. I am the safe choice. The Times Square show is a chance for all of us to see what everyone else is doing, since none of us have representation, and we work in a vacuum. We only see each other at scuzzy nightclubs, on record covers, in underground magazines, on flyers. Life magazine runs a picture of Amos Poe in bed, under a poster for Unmade Beds, with an image of me taking a photograph. It's an article on the new wave. Amos takes his characters and icons from vintage B-movies, cops and call girls, gangsters and hitmen, and weds them to themes of alienation and violence. New wave performers play the parts, and the new music serves as its soundtrack, says the article. The underground is slowly surfacing overground. New books. Bright Orange for the Shroud, John D. MacDonald. Laughter in the Dark, Vladimir Nabokov. November, Georges Simenon. Self-Portrait, Man Ray. Blue Movie, Andy Warhol. The Paper Snake, Ray Johnson. Helen and Desire, Alexander Trocki. The Carnal Days of Helen Seferis, Alexander Trocki. White Thighs, Alexander Trocki. The Woman of Rome, Alberto Moravia. Lunch Poems, Frank O'Hara. The Basketball Diaries, Jim Carroll. The Love Object, Edna O'Brien. Life with Picasso, Francois Giraud. Brideshead Revisited, Evelyn Waugh. Dispatches, Michael Hare. Echoes of Celandine, Derek Marlowe. I Want It Now, Kingsley Amis. That Uncertain Feeling, Kingsley Amis. First Love, Last Rites, Ian McEwan. The Cement Garden, Ian McEwan. Miss Silver's Past, Joseph Scivarecki. Delmore Schwartz, James Atlas. The French Lieutenant's Woman, John Fowles. A Waiting Game, Michael Powell. Heaven and Other Poems, Jack Kerouac. October 7th. Reception at the Mud Club for a seriograph I did of Harry Crosby called Lullaby, edition of 50. Bomb Magazine ran a study for it, full page. One day, while I was on a bender, I was proofing the silkscreen with the printer, and afterwards found myself standing on the corner of 6th Avenue and 14th Street. Who should appear but beautiful Annette, the dreamy girl who screwed me and Dupre on the same sultry night? Long time no see. Are you drunk? She asked. I nodded. Good, she said, and took me to her nearby apartment, after picking up a bottle of champagne. We went straight to bed and feasted on each other like starving carnivores. You've become much more sexual over the past 5 years, she said, smiling. I thought you were ethereal before. She took me to 15th Avenue for dinner and wrote on the inside flap of a matchbook, I love you and New York, with her eyebrow pencil. Passed it across the table to me. It was a memorable, spontaneous, romantic interlude. The kind Greenwich Village was famous for. It was the only time I actually cheated on Terry. I followed the old adage, if you're going to do the time, you may as well do the crime. We went to see Susie and the Banshees at the Academy of Music. New album is Kaleidoscope. Afterwards, we went to Gordon Stevenson's loft for a small after-party. Gordon's in an unlistenable band with Lydia Lunch called Teenage Jesus and the Jerks. Gordon's wife, Muriel, was killed in a car accident. They made a film together called Ecstatic Stigmatic, a gnarly mashup of Catholicism and S&M. Like Gordon's loft, which is heavy on the crucifixions and bondage apparatus. Terry's talking with Susie's drummer and boyfriend, Budgie, a good-looking bottle blonde. I attempt to talk with Susie, a chilly and formidable singer wearing a lot of makeup. I like her, but she's hard work. It is very late, and I am on the wagon and want to go home. Terry says under her breath that Susie and Budgie have invited us back to their Midtown hotel. It's 3 in the morning, I say. Why would we go there at this time of night? She raises an eyebrow. Want to? Oh, I see now. Bit of swinging with the banshees. I cannot imagine getting cozy with Susie, and I don't particularly relish the thought of watching Terry getting boned by Budgie. I don't think so, Terry, I said. She shot me a look that said volumes about what a repressed square I was. Tried to talk me into it. Sorry, there's nothing about this that appeals to me. She goes over to the English rock star couple to decline the offer, feeling very uncool. Sulks all the way home. It seems she's outgrown this romance. She makes me feel like an anchor chained to her ankle. I'm trying to pull out of my personal nosedive while she wants to fearlessly embrace her dark side, overcome her Catholic hang-ups. I don't have any religious repression to rebel against. Don't know much about Jesus, never much cared. What's all the fuss about? Original sin? I don't understand. So this is where we come apart. Apparently the rules have been changed. October 17th. Sam Green works for John and Yoko. He asks if I can do a mock-up logo for Lenono Records, a rising sun morphed with a Union Jack. Overnight, I do. I get a check in the mail for $75, signed by Yoko. I also did some jobs for High Times and Mademoiselle. Did a cover for Dennis Cooper's anthology called Coming Attractions. Halloween 1980. I finally figured out that Terry was having an affair with Shitty Gordon for 6 weeks. I feel a fool, betrayed, insulted, lied to. And now that I know, she's furious at me. Her guilt turns to anger. I talk to her calmly. She gets hysterical. She doesn't listen, only lashes out. She wants to be bad. She's vain, conceited, selfish, hypocritical. She's finally turned into the dominatrix she was pretending to be a few nights a week. Full time now. She says she's got guts to indulge in any urge she may have. Says Gordon was cuckolded by the deceased Muriel, so now he's getting his own back. Gordon is a bisexual creep. He tried to kiss me, too. He looks like a reptile. Sharp widow's peak, the pallor of a chronic masturbator. Slave bracelets. Motorcycle boots. Tattooed, beady-eyed. My rival. Yuck. He's led Terry along, preying on her insecurities and schizophrenia. November 8th, 1980. In response to my being cuckolded, I embarked on a long, joyless, drawn-out bender, as if demonstrating that if anyone was going to hurt me, it would be me doing the hurting. I'm perfectly capable of hurting myself, thank you very much. Tim Dugos dropped by and found me in a semi-comatose state. He was horrified at the condition I was in. No food, just vodka. So made a call and made me promise to go to an address in the neighborhood the following noon. I did, and I found to my surprise that I liked what I heard. So I continued to go every day to learn about this disease that has been calling the shots in my life. I felt hope. They said I didn't have to drink, a novel idea. Of course I have to drink. It's what I do. Not today you don't, they said. Tomorrow's another day. It's only a day at a time. You don't have to quit for the rest of your life. I told someone there I was wary of getting brainwashed. He said, "Well, no offense, but your brain could use a bit of a washing." Sadly, I still live with Terry. If she would just move in with her rotten Don Juan, it would be a lot easier. She tries to provoke me, taunts me, tests me, doesn't like my new sobriety. She can't take my disapproval. Tough shit. I don't have all the answers. I'm tired of who's right and who's wrong. I'm just a 28-year-old alcoholic painter. I want no more scenes. There was a doozy of a scene. She came home one afternoon after a night with her bit of rough trade, Gordon. They're reading Nietzsche together. She told me they want to kill a homeless person and roll him into the Hudson, so they can tick that sin off the list. I told her she was crazy. She told me I was a conservative, repressed bore. "Just because I draw the line at murder," I said. "Okay, then. If that makes me square, I guess I am." This ignited her fury. She followed me into the kitchen. My back was to her. But a second sight made me suddenly duck. She had hurled a full glass jar of Hellman's mayonnaise at my head, which exploded on the wall in front of me with such violence that the pieces were propelled into every corner of the apartment, not just the kitchen. It sounded like a grenade going off. It would have stove in my skull. I turned, my adrenaline giving me immediate superhuman strength. I walked over to her, lifted her up by the neck with one hand, as if she weighed a pound. Her feet were dangling in the air. I looked at this fucked-up bitch and realized if she could just cease to exist, all my problems would be gone. It was a powerful impulse, one that I've never had before and hope to never have again. I said, "Okay, that's it. You've pushed me as far as I can go, but you can't push me anymore. That's it. You're done. Now I want you to get out of here because it's not safe for you here, not now. So get the fuck out." And then I saw something in her terror-stricken face, that made me sick. A wave of admiration passed over her, even desire. I squeezed her neck one last time and set her down. She left. I was still pulsing with a murderous energy like I'd never, ever felt. I went to the bathroom mirror to see who I had become. I hardly recognized myself. I looked completely feral, like the Wolfman, my teeth bared, my nostrils extended, my eyes ablaze. I've come to see that it's a blessing that Gordon stole Terry away. In fact, it's the best thing that could have happened. How would I ever have gotten out of that toxic relationship otherwise? Maybe I thought it's what I deserved, water finding its own level, etc. Alcoholism does a real number on your self-esteem. We didn't have to be together. In fact, it was a terrible idea. I'm free, white, and 28. I've got a rosy future ahead of me. It's so nice to wake up without a hangover. My imagination roams freely. I experience nuances I never knew, attentive to little sensations. I've been my own worst enemy for years. I do a painting called Pink Clouds that is of the rooftops of Montmartre. It looks the way I feel, out of the storm. Saw Tom Waits on stage. He sang, "If I exercise my devils, well, my angels may leave too." I used to think that too. I don't anymore. Suffering is not imperative. Being cynical is a cop-out. Hip negativity is just another form of conformity. If I feel the world is horrible, to be horrible myself would just be adding to the problem. The path of least resistance would be to submit to the inevitable course, and just become another fatality of Bohemia's wicked ways. As if I was passively going along with the downward flow. That's not me, not who I was, not who I want to be. I have a choice in the matter. I can fight back. Wouldn't the brave option be to try to live a positive life? Wouldn't that be rebellion? December 1980. I was interviewed by Patrick Roques for Vacation Magazine out of San Francisco. Article called The New Romantic. I told some of my ghost stories. Talked about how misconceptions can be an asset. Bohemia. The nobility of being a painter. I did another interview with an artsy magazine out of Belgium called Sold, with some nice photos. The interpreter was an English painter, Michael Bastow, who lives in Paris. Terrific draftsman. We became pals. December 8th, 1980. Terry and I were having a hamburger up on Columbus Avenue. I saw John Lennon's face on TV above the bar, sound off. He's always in the news because of his Double Fantasy album. That album about the bogus love affair between him and Yoko. We pay up and walk down the avenue approaching 72nd Street. A madman is screaming in the street. At 72nd Street, I look east and see a small group of people congregated in front of the Dakota. Uh-oh. We walk over. People are crying. Yellow police tape and squad cars. John's been shot. They've got the assassin, just a kid from Hawaii. A very strange vigil begins as more and more mourners show up. It's incredibly sad. Trial and Error. January 18th, 1981. I meet Anna Taylor in Club 57. She's dressed as Joan of Arc for some kind of performance, like a school play costume. So pretty. Beautiful skin, crooked teeth, blue hair. She smells good, too. She's 25 and on the scene. Cool, nutty, nervous, gamine, smart. Has a creative way of talking, lots of wordplay. I went home and watched a horse-buckled spy movie on the Late Show. Cuckoo lies in my stomach and watches me watching. She loves me. She reads my mind. It occurs to me that all this time I've been treating her as a cat. I don't even know what a cat is, really. I apologize to her. February 6th. I rendezvous with Anna at Café des Artistes. I learn she's from Ottawa by way of Ann Arbor, broken home. She plays bass in a band with tall drummer Jim Sklavounos called Matter Lake. Used to go out with Jean-Michel Basquiat, which you could say for legions of downtown girls. She's wearing checkered jodhpurs. She steals a hard-boiled egg, kicks it down the street. We go to the Rock Lounge on Canal Street to see the Lounge Lizards. We like Arto Lindsay's Skronk guitar. She lives in a storefront on East 10th Street, makes a living as a seamstress, writes songs. I walk her home, kiss her goodnight. February 8th. Anna and I are circling each other, unsure of the other, but intrigued by the connection that seems to be growing. This is the first time in my life I've courted someone sober. Very different enterprise. Sometimes awkward. I feel vulnerable as hell. No artificial shock absorbers to smooth out the road. No Irish courage. She's about to leave my apartment one night, and I ask her to stay, saying we have to see where this goes. We undress. She is extremely beautiful, breathtaking. All is revealed in bed, all the pent-up desire, the tenderness, the intensity, the excitement. A primeval union a wordless articulation of how we feel towards another. Closer to the wonder of it all. I feel reborn. Then, we're just plain old.